Oh, Sister C, you are not a singer. Let me tell you, every little thing we do, that's right, it is for you. As a radio programmer, I make radio with you in mind. And I'm so grateful that you're there listening. I am Charlotte Farrell, Sister C, your own Sister C, host of the Saluau Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon What You've Heard show every Friday morning at 10 o'clock. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Every little thing we do it just for you.
To Cancria, home of Canada's queer media, and I am caffeinated.
Oh.
Also known as Luke Smith.
And I am Sebastian, who's also known as Sebastian.
This is true, aka Sebastian. You're also the artist formerly known as Sebastian.
True.
This is true, all the way through. All
formerly and currently.
Currently and potentially.
Yeah.
Forthcoming.
Yeah, there was a middle period where I was known as Sebastian.
Yes, that's your Sebastian period. Yeah. All right, well, welcome to Cancria. We're going to be talking about all things gay. And we're starting it off with a Beveragino.
Okay.
With, specifically, I mentioned being caffeinated because I am currently enjoying my second rather large ice cold coffee, or ice coffee.
Yes.
Ice latte, cold coffee.
Okay.
I have had one of them already. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can tell. But there has been quite a few queer folks talking about food recently.
Okay.
At the Food Conference 2024, I am first of all absolutely devastated that I did not know about the Food Conference 2024 until after it happened.
I thought you were going to say that you're devastated you weren't invited. But
I am devastated I wasn't invited. It took place in Boston University. It was in person and hybrid.
Okay.
And it also had a bit of a connection with the Institute for Gender, Sexuality and Feminist Studies up in McGill. McGill is Montreal?
Yes.
Yes. Wonderful. My memory is serving me correctly.
It's sort of halfway up the mountain.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, the New York Times did an excellent piece on the food. What is queer food?
Okay.
Seems to have been the gist of the whole conference. Now, what they say, we'll start off with what they say on the website, and we'll sort of float around with some of the ideas. It says, what is queer food? It brought together scholars, activists, food people, journalists, and so
food people. Who's not a food people?
People who food.
People who... Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Now, I mean, you say that, but, like, I know there was a TikTok trend called a bottom diet, which was just a picture with a bowl with a single ice cube. So maybe they're not... Not every gay person is a food person.
Right.
That could be the case. How do we define food? How do we engage with food? How does food relate to queer history, queer culture? Mm-hmm. How are we queering food? What I like is how they've kind of applied the academic term of queer to food.
Okay.
Now, for our audience who maybe haven't been diving into the queer lens, as it were, which is not Elton John's glasses.
Okay.
It is something completely different. Would you mind, for the audience, just sharing with us what you understand the queer lens of queering something to mean?
Okay, so the most neutral definition of queering something is something that actually I think everyone could get on board with to a certain degree. Even, like, there's people who think, you know, gender studies, queer academia, they may not be fully on board with everything they study, but I think this is a version of something that I think everyone could appreciate. So when you take a queer approach to something, you're basically looking at it from the outsider's lens.
Yeah.
So my favorite example of how to queer something in a very scientific way there's all sorts of research from the 70s and 80s about how men, on average, are more attracted to beautiful women in a red dress. It just, they react to it more strongly. They did this research so they would know what to put in advertising. So all throughout the 80s, you saw a lot more women in red dresses than you saw before the 80s because of this research. Queering it would be looking at it from the perspective of, okay, well, what's the second most liked color of dresses on women by heterosexuals? Or of those men who prefer women in red dresses, what do they have in common that everyone else doesn't have in common? It's sort of looking at it from the perspective of, okay, but what's next? Or what else? Or what also? Or what is the okay, you've determined what the center of the bell curve is. You've determined the largest category. You've determined the most popular whatever. Okay, what's outside of that? And that is the perspective of queering that I think, social sciences and psychology in general has a problem with just saying, we found the center of the bell curve. We know what the largest category is. We know what the most popular, the most liked thing is. End of study. And very few people go on to the next step of saying, okay, well, what else? What also? Or what do they have in common? Or the why of it? And this sort of like secondary step, that is the queering of it. Now, what can also happen if you're looking at social sciences, and this is how it's sort of a hybrid of what I just said and what you might expect if it's coming from like a gender studies thing, is from a social phenomenon, what is the outsider's perspective in general, which originates from the queer experience, but doesn't have to be the queer experience. It could be like the Indigenous Canadian experience. It could be rural versus metropolitan. It could be, it could just be what's the outsider's perspective.
I have an example of that. When I was in my university days, I was looking at applying the queer lens to international relations.
Okay.
So, you know, we've got the big power struggles, you know, the East versus the West or what have you, United States versus China. But then you look at, okay.
But then how does Tobago fit into this?
Yeah, I want to know what Lesotho is thinking about this particular, you know, what do the Danes think of this?
Botswana's on the up and up. Where do they fit in?
Yeah, because the conversation becomes monopolized about the...
China, Russia, US.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Think about it in terms of queer folks.
Yeah.
1 in 10 people are queer. So if the conversation is talking about those 9 out of 10 people all the time, or any relationship, any dynamic, we're always talking about the majority thing. What queering does is look at, okay, but what about that 1 in 10? What about that outsider? What about the other? It's essentially studying the other, which you nailed in terms of the definition.
But it can also be done for like chemistry and physics. Like it doesn't have to be about social phenomena. I think the term, because it does involve the term queer, it can feel like a loaded term. I don't think it has to be, but... I understandably, like, I know some people who kind of, they cringe at the term. They like, they love the concept of it. They love the idea of why aren't we doing more, but then what kind of research, but they may not react well to the exact term because it does feel like it's coming out of queer and gender studies, which if you're like, well, because there are people who take that literally as well. Like, what is the bisexual attitude towards the force of gravity? And like, I've read papers, maybe not exactly like that, but things like that. Like, you know, what is the gender nonconforming perspective on the weak magnetic force? And you're just like, what are you doing with your time here? Whereas if you're looking at it from the perspective of like, why isn't literature studying the weak force more? That's a queering approach that I think even most physicists would be like, yeah, we should look into that.
Well, at the food conference, They saw that nice, neat definition that we said, and they were like, no. We want a broader, uncategorized... They want to be more vague, is how they've approached this particular thing. And their definition is really interesting. They're like, what do you serve? This is what one of the panelists said, according to the New York Times.
Okay.
What do you serve at a topless lesbian gathering? I mean, it's probably going to be vegan.
Corn salad.
Corn salad, absolutely.
Yeah.
Easy to clean up.
I don't know why, but it was just, there's something my brain was like, obviously it's going to be...
Obviously corn salad.
It's going to be a picnic food. It's going to involve seasonal vegetables. But also,
queer food is the pie that was thrown in the face of Anita Bryant.
Okay.
The anti-queer activist that was, you know. But like, food that's been politicized in queer history is now queer food.
Okay.
So... Sebastian,
yes.
to you.
Yeah.
What is queer food?
Okay. So before the episode, Luke told me we would be talking about queer food, but gave me no details.
No details.
So I thought about this, and I have three answers. I think there's three branches of queer food, okay?
Brunch?
No. So first I would say is food is a status symbol, because there's a lot of status obsession with, status and appearance obsession within the community. So being seen specifically with a Starbucks iced coffee macchiato with the seasonal whatever flavor they're squirting in there. So it's not just that you're seen with a cup of iced coffee in your hand, but specifically it has that logo on there because there is a status associated with that logo. So you've got like food as status. The second thing I would say is food as convenience, because I know a lot, and I mean a lot, of like LGBTQ folks who know nothing about cooking. They can barely boil water. So you get there. I mean, these are the kind of people who are like, they follow the Instapot recipe on how to make, spaghetti and meatballs all in one. And it just turns out with the spaghetti turns into paste. The sauce is no good. And the meatballs are weirdly undercooked, even though everything else is overcooked. And the last thing I would say is historic cooking.
Hmm.
And I'm thinking about this from the perspective of, like, if you've ever seen Tasting History with Max, can't remember his last name, gay man, he cooks all these recipes from, like, the past 800 years, basically, trying to find original versions of things. There is a huge gay audience who watches all these cooking shows that focus on 100-year-old, 200-year-old, 300-year-old recipes. What is the original version of the red velvet pie? If you put beet juice or any food coloring in your red velvet, you're not making red velvet correctly. You're just making a devil's food cake with food coloring. So what is the original recipe? And I was thinking about that specific. What is it? The first two are kind of like self-evident.
I have a theory, actually.
I think it has to do with the obsession with authenticity.
I think it has to do with grandmothers.
Grandmothers. Well,
now, hear me out. Okay. Gay men in particular, I can speak from that experience, generally develop a closer affinity to their grandmothers more than any other characters. Gay men and mothers are like peas in a pod.
Okay.
And particularly the relationship between gay men and their grandmothers is also very well defined.
Okay.
You know, a mama's boy, a grandma's boy. I think that's bled into how gay men interact with food.
Okay. Well then, I mean, still I would say that there's that aspect of the relationship between authenticity and food, because like, after I discovered that I cannot process gluten and I had to cook everything from scratch, I went on a mission to learn how to not make gluten-free versions of things I already know, but things that never had gluten in them. And as a result, I ended up learning how to make a lot of Mexican food. So there is a Mexican breakfast taco, and I have scoured the internet for the original Mexico City 1940s version of this breakfast taco. And because if I'm going to make it's an egg and potato taco. If I'm going to make this, I want to make it the quote unquote correct way. The thing about the correct way is that sometimes, like, the original version from, like, 400 years ago is actually no good, and things have developed for a reason. We've added more salt or less water or whatever to the thing. New ingredients, thickening agents, you know, maybe xanthan gum in cakes. We do that for a reason. But, I don't know, there's still that obsession of what is the original. I mean, like, what I was saying, like, obviously I spent the time to figure out what the original red velvet recipe was. And what made it different? What makes a red velvet cake something that's not just a devil's food chocolate cake with red dye in it? And it was that idea of what is the authentic experience of having cacio e pepe, of having shepherd's pie, of having sushi, of having whatever, you know?
I want to double back just a little bit, because you had mentioned earlier about iced macchiatos and iced coffees being status. I don't think you're entirely wrong, but I think that a lot of things that sort of permeate queer culture, specifically gay culture, have roots that are worth exploring from a queer history perspective.
Okay.
And I think we can't underestimate here the role of the gay barista.
Okay.
So
to me, I think that has more to do with consumerism culture being really big.
Hear me out. Okay. In lots of communities, you might get one or two Starbuckses, mm-hmm. and it was nearly always a place of fair and open employment mm-hmm. for gay men. If you're effeminate, doesn't matter, as long as you can make a macchiato. You know what I mean? And over the last 10, 20 odd years,
okay.
it's become that go-to entryway job, that sort of first level job for so many gay men and queer folks.
But you know, it wasn't Starbucks that created that reputation.
No, I know. But then, you know, but Starbucks, I think, has democratized it in terms of rolling it out into every small town and city.
Yeah, because the original was actually, it wasn't just Second Cup, which is a Canadian thing, mm-hmm. but specifically the Second Cup on Queen Street in Toronto, which they made a big deal out of in Kids in the Hall, the mm-hmm. steps skit. All the gay men sitting on the steps and drinking a nice coffee and commenting on all the guys walking past. That was the steps on the corner of the big corner. The corner that defines the gay community in Toronto.
Oh, Church and Wellesley?
Church and Wellesley. Not Queen Street. It was Church and Wellesley.
How you say the big corner. I'm like, immediately.
Church and Wellesley. And it was because, it wasn't because Second Cup just happened to be on the corner of Church and Wellesley. It was also because they were the first major corporate entity in Canada to extend benefits to same-sex partners.
Yeah.
So the association between the gay community and coffee chains kind of came out of that. Mm-hmm. And then I think Starbucks, because they're international, when they picked it up, they exploded.
If you ask gay guys, have you ever worked in a coffee shop? I've worked in the coffee shop.
I haven't.
You haven't.
But I worked in a gay bar.
But you worked in a gay bar. You know what I mean? I think, is it the status symbol? Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
But do I think that there is a cultural affinity and a sort of element there that draws iced coffee and queer folks together? Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And even then, if you go back in history, there was a huge... if you read books from the 50s, the Beatnik era, the coffee and juice bar, the sort of non-alcoholic space that kind of became known for like scat jazz and you know, improv, free form, like the sort of invention of the slam poet during the Beatnik era, those spaces were also known as being disproportionately gay and lesbian, even though they weren't really gay bars. It was just, mm-hmm. it was a jazz juice and coffee bar, but there was a large number of gay and lesbians in there. And I mean, partly it could have just been that the Beatniks were mostly gay. They were there. So therefore there was quite a few gay people there. You know, the William S. Burroughs and the Jack Kerouac and the Ginsbergs, you know, they kind of, by being there and bringing their friends, they by default made these spaces gay. But still, there was that association between coffee and the gay community. And it's, I don't know, it's this weird historic thing that I think kind of when people talk about gay history, it doesn't come up that often.
Yeah, how many people think about queer folk? I don't know what it is about brunch that makes it particularly gay.
Oh, I do.
Okay, what is it about brunch? Is it the poached eggs?
No, it's because
the hollandaise sauce, isn't it?
Most places that have brunch deals have it on Sunday.
Mm.
And if you go heavy drinking on Saturday night, which is pretty common in the gay community, and then you try to get together for breakfast, but you can't get together from breakfast because you're all hungover.
But you can do brunch.
And brunch comes with mimosas. You get a little bit of the hair of the dog.
When I asked Jake what's gay food, he immediately said mimosas.
Mimosas, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's worth noting. I think you're right. I think that sort of, you know, the morning after the night before vibe makes sense. But when we think about it, that is also a preserve of younger folks who have the energy to be up all night and then do brunch first thing in the morning. And younger generations are nearly always gayer than the generation before. People sort of...
I think if you're looking at gay men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, it's that on a Sunday morning, they get up and they do all the stuff that like adults do. They do the
gardening,
banking, do some groceries.
Run some errands. But, you know, I'll go for brunch.
And then they meet their friends for brunch after already being up for 7 hours because for some reason they it's that weird thing that happens as you get older. You need less sleep, but you're on the schedule of a younger person. So you sleep for 4 hours and then you just wake up and you can't get back to sleep.
The last thing I want to mention about queer food. This conference, I'm going to go over some of the things that they talked about. But
yes.
The last thing that I was thinking about when it comes to queerness and food is about where queer folks gather and live.
Yeah.
And that cross-connection and shared cuisines. Now, what I mean by this is, you know, before gentrification, queer folks are systematically underemployed. The average queer person makes less money than the average straight person.
And I think that's what I said earlier about the association with quick foods and instant foods and cheap foods. I think a lot of that comes from that. So a lot of people I know that, you know, gays and lesbians and various other that I knew who knew nothing about cooking, it's because they didn't learn anything from their parents because they came from a working class family.
Or they were ousted as a young age, and maybe they didn't have that familial connection.
Yeah.
But I think what happens is it's not just gay folks that are disproportionately less likely to have higher incomes.
Yeah.
It's also ethnocultural minorities, new immigrants, and those folks that would tend to live in similar or the same neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of interaction of food that happens there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Really fascinating conversations. I am, like I said, a little bit disappointed that I wasn't personally invited. But they talk about making community through cooking and eating.
Yep.
Eating design and ritual. These cookies are going to change your life. Self-expression through pastry. Oh my God, the gays that make pastry. So many of them. It's a huge thing.
Years ago, we had, he's pretty busy these days for bad reasons, unfortunately. But remember when we had Maurice on the show every so often? So Maurice is one of the leading gay rights activists in Jamaica. And he spoke frequently about not just how pride in Jamaica, but social events in general are almost exactly like an afternoon tea social. And the tea social is a cultural phenomenon. It's just a way of doing a party in the Caribbean and some parts of West Africa where it's like music, food, dancing. And it's the three of them at the same time. It's done when the sun's up. When the sun goes down, everyone goes home. It's not a night party. It's definitely a day party, but it's all about the food and the music and hanging out with your friends. And I've heard people from South Africa comment that the braai is basically just a South African barbecue, that a lot of the gay events there are sort of focused around the braai. So, and here, when you talk about like gay men, a lot of them, they go to those, there's camps like trailer parks just for gay men, and they go there and they do their barbecue.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
the bears love a camp.
Bears love barbecue. And lesbians love barbecue, too. They love chicken wings.
Outdoorsy gays.
Yeah.
Outdoorsy gays are the whole thing. Yeah.
So there is associations with, like, I think some of it's chosen family stuff. Like, what is a thing that people do with their families? Okay, let's replicate that. So there is definitely that. And trying to make a space that sort of uses food as a tool. The lesbian potluck.
We always talk about the lesbian potluck. In fact, I'm having a party coming up soon. I am sorry I have not individually invited each of our listeners. That's on me. But we have a party coming up and we have rolled out lesbian potluck rules.
Yeah.
Because it is about that community building. Yes. What's the key thing in the lesbian potluck rules, Sebastian?
Oh, right. Okay. So everyone who comes has to bring something. One of three things. You have to bring a single friend. And it has to be a single friend. Someone who doesn't know the rest of the community.
Needs to get out more.
And you're bringing them along to introduce them to people. Maybe they meet someone. Maybe they just make a friend. It doesn't matter. Maybe they just have a nice time. Second thing could be a covered dish, and it has to be a home-cooked meal because that stimulates conversation. You bring a thing, and they're like, oh my God, who made this? What's the recipe?
Have you seen Ian's mac and cheese?
If you remember, I still talk about this, the house party where I brought ambrosia, and everyone was staring at it like, what is that nonsense?
Oh, the guy that brought crickets.
Everyone got sick. And the last thing is, if you don't have the time to make a covered dish or a home cooked meal, and you don't have a single friend, then you just bring
booze. A bottle of something.
Because
some slight libations that can be shared.
Yeah,
Social lubricants.
Those three things, everyone brings at least one of those, and then you got yourself a potluck.
I love, because what I really like about it is, sure, not everyone can afford to bring a bottle of something, but it's that bringing a single friend piece, yeah. because we tend to stick to the people we know.
Yeah.
And as we get older, our friendship circles shrink. So actively engaging and participating in building your social networks.
Yeah.
And it's always worth mentioning that Canada as a whole has a loneliness crisis.
Oh, yeah.
But in the queer community, it is...
It's pretty
bad. It's dialed up.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of folks who are suffering from lack of engagement, lack of good conversation, and being alone. And if you want to come and talk about the crickets and Ian's MacDs, then that's a great way to spend the afternoon. You know what I mean? I think that's what I love about it. Oh, the ambrosia. The ambrosia was fantastic.
My favorite part about it, though, was everybody... First, it stimulated conversation because everyone's like, what is that? And who would dare eat it? And then somebody dared eat it. And then they hit it. And everyone's like, where did it go? And it just turned out that he was eating it all because he underestimated how... Ambrosia, in case you don't know, is also known as the salad with a little marshmallows in it. Mm-hmm. It's basically just a bowl of sugar.
It's like Minnesota salads are not really a salad.
Oh, it's so good. But yeah, no, it doesn't look like something that would taste good, but it absolutely is.
We do love a theme.
Yeah.
As the gays.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we have been nattering on about food.
What did they say, though? Did we get around to that?
Yeah, I mentioned a couple. The last thing I wanted to mention is it's obviously about food and politics. How do you effectively fundraise with food? And more importantly, the great one I think would be really interesting is food as nutrition and health. Food for sustenance and support has played with the HIV and AIDS epidemic, and how queer folks need to also take care of ourselves.
I've known at least 5 gay or bisexual men, specifically men, but I mean, I'm sure that you can find others, but who do the thing where every meal is an unseasoned chicken breast, brown rice, and broccoli. And it's the weight loss, muscle gain diet that all the movie stars do before they get into a Marvel film.
I don't think they do, but...
A lot of them do, though.
So, but yeah. you're not wrong. There are more gays with anorexia, more gays with bigorexia.
Yeah.
You know, there's more eating disorders with the average gay community than with the average straight community. It's not great. Our relationship with food is...
It's either unhealthy or way too healthy.
I.e. the bears. But, I do love a good pie, so we'll get to that. Anyway, we are jumping to our first track.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Lobotomize Me. This is giving Rolling Stone vibes. I thought it was surfer rock. You clarified.
Yeah.
And this is by Cosmic Club. This is Lobotomize Me, a great new Canadian artist. And we will be back just after